Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter and producer at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a weekly series of coronavirus conversations presented jointly with The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, taking your questions to the experts. This discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you here in The World's podcast feed. This last week, we took a look at the links between racism, the pandemic, inequities, and policing. Joining me was David Harris, Managing Director of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard's Law School. David, to start, demonstrations are continuing across the country and world in response to the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Rayshard Brooks. We know these are just the latest examples of a long and deep history of injustice in policing and incarceration in communities of color. At the same time, we're seeing that Black Americans are getting sick and dying from COVID-19 at far higher rates than white Americans. So to start, what are your impressions of this moment, and where do you think we could be heading next?
Well, greetings, and I want to thank you and the School of Public Health and WGBH for putting this on. I really appreciate the opportunity. So it's a difficult question. It's a difficult time, obviously. You know, there's part of me that thinks that maybe we are approaching a turning point in our history. I'm reluctant to say that we've reached it, because I think we've seen similar moments, if not quite this exactly. You know, and I'm a child of the 60s. You know, I grew up protesting the Vietnam War. You know, we thought we were going to change the world then. And here I am 50 years later, really in a way asking myself the same question. You know, later tonight I'll do an event thinking about Tulsa. And here we are almost 100 years after Tulsa. And those folks still have not been made whole. So, you know, I think we have a history in this country of taking two steps forward and one step backwards, and that's what we call progress. So, like everybody else, I'm clearly devastated by the murders that define this year and the deaths that have come about through the pandemic. But I also think that all of these things have combined to reveal the extent to which racism and racial injustice are defining qualities and characteristics of our society. Mm. And I think on some level, I am actually buoyed by the response that we see. In our work, we recognize that we think of citizenship as being both membership and participation in society, that it's not just voting or passports or what have you, but that there's a quality of membership that's conveyed that citizenship means, and that membership allows for participation. So, you know, as the war in Vietnam and the war on poverty were replaced by the war on crime and war on drugs, part of that war was an attack and a destruction of the sense of membership that many people had in our society, especially people of color living in our cities where these war on crime and war on drugs were fought. So to kind of expect people to vote in that context is a little bit cynical and maybe even a little bit cruel. There are other forms of participation that we have to find. And I think we're starting to see it now. I think we're seeing, you know, there's this common phrase today that enough is enough. And you know, I remember after Michael Brown's murder, Charles Ogletree and I wrote a column, and we said, you know, it's more than enough. Even then, we were at more than enough. It was too much. And here we are, you know, years later, and we're living this again. Mm-hmm. But what gives me hope is that that what we see today on the street is led by young people, it's led by women of color, it's led by people who are starting to demand that their voices be heard in developing, conceiving, and imagining the kinds of public policies that they think will solve the problems they face. And I think that's, to me, that's a very significant juncture. And then finally, I'd say, you know, I want us to remind ourselves of Dr. King's letter from the Birmingham jail. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing, you know, there's a lot of work going on in anti-racism. I think it's very important, but I think it's also very important that people read Dr. King's letter to get an understanding of what it really means to be an ally. And so I'm actually reminded of the work of Bryan Stevenson, who has been calling for a reckoning, who has been preparing us for that reckoning, and this notion that he has of proximity. And his idea, you know, he talks about the need to be proximate. And I think that the coronavirus and the lynchings have made us all more proximate to the racial injustice in our society. And the challenge for us to stay on the street and exercise whatever power we have to get around this corner. We have a history of backlash, but I think, and I'm hopeful, almost hopeful against, you know, hoping against hope, that with sustained effort, we will turn this corner. So, yes.
When you think about this moment and the approaches in turning that corner, and people taking to the streets, a lot of people are calling to, quote, defund the police. What exactly does that mean? And do you see that as being part of that approach?
Well, the word exactly is going to throw me there. So I'm not going to presume to say exactly, but I'll give you some thoughts. You know, the notion of defunding, I think, you know, is something that's come out of kind of work that people have been doing around abolishing the police for years and years and years. And one of the mechanisms certainly is to begin by limiting the resources that the police have to do the damage that they do. So I think. I think the idea is that the police are endowed with too many resources, and I think part of what's happened is that one of the things that's become very clear in the last few weeks is that there's a real question about the police's legitimate use of force, right? That is one of the things that defines the police, that they're imbued with a legitimate use of force, and they have been using it illegitimately and getting away with it. And the fewer resources they have, the less harm they can do. Now, we can get into this kind of what to do with the defunding, you know, as a kind of separate, I'd like to take that as a separate conversation. But I do think that taking, you know, that decreasing the amount of resources that they have is a critical step toward the path to abolition, yes, but also toward the path to allowing a different kind of safety and healing to take place in our communities. So we can talk about the investment part now or later or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, what are some of the ways or examples set forward to provide that safety and healing? What kinds of examples are doing that, or would you like to see?
Well, so there's a context I'd like to place here, and it's one, you know, that I feel strongly about, and others are also championing. I think we need to have two conversations. We have to have a conversation about defunding the police in its own terms. We need to shrink the budgets and the power and the force of the police. On the other hand, the coronavirus has revealed to us that we also need to invest massive amounts of resources in our communities. And I don't think that, for instance, here in Boston, taking $12 million of police overtime and putting it into so-called community projects is meaningful. It doesn't come close to the scope of what we need to do, and it shows a total lack of political will. The kind of political will that allowed us to come up with trillions of dollars to address the coronavirus, right? We created money to do that. Why? Because it was deemed an emergency, and we had the political will to do it. Now, to resolve the issues that face our communities that are revealed by the coronavirus is going to take much more money than that. And in order to raise that money, we need this reckoning. That's a test of the extent to which we have actually reckoned with what we have wrought is the extent to which we're willing to make those investments on their own terms. And so there are groups that are leading efforts to rebuild our cities in a different way and with a different image, a different view toward safety and healing. And I think we need to recognize and honor those that are taking place in every city in the country. And that's, I think it's, they've been underfunded and overlooked, but we can find them. You can go on our website, you can find a bunch and, we can kind of hook you up with them, but they exist everywhere, Alana. And that's part of the real issue is kind of understanding that our communities are rich in assets, right? Mm. Not just deficits, and that we need to recognize that and honor those people with the resources they need.
There's a lot of questions coming in, and I have questions too, but I wanted to get to one now just about the complicated and both blatant but also subtle ways that the pandemic is intertwined with these inequities and with racism. This question is from Sahaya from Down to Earth magazine. And she asks, how has COVID-19 brought some of these problems to the fore? As an example, Black Americans are dying more due to comorbidities like hypertension. And how has the pandemic affected the most vulnerable?
But we only have a half hour, right? and I say that jokingly because the answer is vast. There are so many ways. There are ways about kind of the things that have gotten a lot of publicity that we know that the pre-existing conditions that increase the likelihood of morbidity are differentially distributed across racial groups and across neighborhoods and by geography, it can be mapped. We know, one of the things that, my institute does work on, we've been working on trying to decarcerate, to try to address the really horrible circumstances under which people are being held in cages as this disease ravages the nation. And, it's fascinating to hear a lot of the corrections people will say things like, well, but they have no place to go, right? That, they're safer in prison than they are on the streets. And, So rather, it's kind of like broken windows policing. The idea of broken windows policing that you respond to it by more policing and not fixing the windows, right? So in the same way, the issue that's being exposed by the difficulties these corrections folks have in releasing people back home has to do with the conditions on the ground back home that we haven't addressed, right? So if there's not affordable housing, if there's not sufficient health care, if HUD regulations say that you can't return to public housing coming from incarceration, these are things on the ground, and these aren't parts of the conversation people are talking about, but they're real. They're examples of. Correspondence question, there are lots of study, there are lots of data out there. But there was a study that I think MIT that was reported in the Globe a couple of days ago by MIT researchers that I think was very revealing. And they tried to map, I'm not sure if it was contagion or death, but they tried to map the extent of the virus geographically and by race. And they tried to limit and cut out any possible intervening variables. Having done that, having controlled for as many as they could, they still had these racial disparities. And one of the things that they talked about is the fact that it is likely the case that many people of color are either underinsured or not insured, which means that they probably don't have a primary care physician, right? Which means that when they appear in the emergency room looking for care, they're at a definite disadvantage to the person whose primary care physician has called ahead and said, I want you to take care of my patient, right? It's the way in which the institutional racism, for lack of a better word, seeps down into some very, very specific and particular differences in treatment that you wouldn't know if you didn't ask the question, right? Mm. So, and, you know, again, there's, you know, there are other examples, you know, there are triage protocols that are being thought of and adopted to kind of address end of life care, in a scarcity. You know, how do we decide who gets care and who doesn't, you know? And some of the early models for that were based on things like, you know, life expectancy, the existence of those pre-existing conditions, and then choosing, kind of giving more points to those who had longer life expectancy or who didn't have a lot of those pre-existing conditions. Never mind that those pre-existing conditions were concentrated in people with disabilities, the elderly, and people of color. So part of the question is, you know, who's, now I'm going off track here, but.
No, but I mean, I don't know that you're going off track, because what you're talking about is the ways that there are very obvious ways when we look at statistics and we see these numbers, but then there's also ways even in the care itself,
right.
Ways that can be, it's not an issue necessarily of biology. And in fact, there are ways that this is ingrained, so much so what you're saying, in how healthcare, how policies are designed. So
and how we practice. I mean, it has to do with the practice, and we don't interrogate that, right? I mean, so again, in this moment, it is my hope that having kind of peeled back the Teflon, you know, will allow us to start to look at these questions and listen to the answers and start to develop policies that are designed to correct those rather than the kind of band-aids that we're inclined to come up with.
So. I just want to remind viewers that this is a Facebook Live, so we're taking your questions. You can put them in the queue and we'll try to get to them as a Facebook Live with Harvard's Chan School of Public Health, the Forum, and the World from GBH and PRX. I just want to connect something that you said in the beginning with these issues from different aspects of this moment. And given the work that you've done for quite a long time, you mentioned Michael Brown and that moment and this moment now. And when you think of this opening that's exposing all of this even more blatantly, enough is enough, you're seeing in the streets. What do you see as ways to move that forward? In the ways that we can see it or talk about it, but how in your work, how do you see that moving forward to actually bring those conversations into something that will lead to change?
Well, on some level, more of the same and a little bit different. You know, I like to say, you know, we live in a country where, for the purposes of elections, corporations are viewed as citizens, right? That's what, you know, one of those bizarre twists, right? And in the face, and the question always arises, how do we address that in the face of that wealth and power? And the answer to that is that, you know, that we vote with our feet. We take to the streets. We have to stay on the streets, right? That's one part of it. The other part of it is, I'll say here in Boston, you know, we have a city council in Boston that is women of color who understand these things, who get these things, who are connected to members of the community. And I think it's the responsibility of those of us who are on the streets to push and pull and work with the elected officials to change policy directions. So that's one thing. The other thing I think, and this goes to the Birmingham jail question. I think our work that we call community justice grew out of a recognition that, we have this rhetorical question about the death penalty. You know, what kind of society are we that chooses to spend the resources we do on vindicating the death penalty that is used largely to protect white victims, right? What I call white lives matter, right? Before black lives matter, white lives have always mattered. So what do we call a society that chooses to spend resources the way we do while entire communities of color are starved for resources? You know, the answer to the question is simple. It's a rhetorical question. We call that a society unjust. But the question itself was wrong. And that's what we came to realize. And the reason it's wrong is because we aren't deciding. They are deciding. Hmm. People, you know, other people are deciding. People who live in suburban communities, you know, who control the legislature, who control the policy directions. Those are the folks we have to also move and mobilize. Right? And so from my perspective, I think one of the things in this moment, one of the tests in this moment is going to be the extent to which people outside of the cities, people who, you know, and I think it's great that people are coming in and they're marching and side by side, you know, but when they go back home, when they go back to their districts, you know, they need to be forces for change. They need to demand that their legislators support the work of people identifying issues on the ground, and they need to stick with it. And the problem, I think, you know, that we have in this country is we get tired, right? We go back to normal. We had our moment of revelation. And then we curl up again in the cocoons of normalcy. And so I think it's going to be really important not only that we stay on the streets, but that we mobilize and organize across communities and get people to kind of stay in this battle and stay in this struggle. So I think it's, you know, it's a challenge in this country.
Bringing it kind of closer in, this question comes from online. What is the role of institutions of higher learning like Harvard in advancing changes?
Oh, again, all my talking points here. So I think, you know, I have said for a long time that aside from wanting to change the way public policy is delivered, it has been my hope to change the way institutions like Harvard think about leadership. I think, you know, we look to Harvard and MIT and all those places to show us the way, right? And I think that's wrong. I think it's the role of institutions of learning, institutions of power, to try to learn how to listen, and more than listen, hear what people on the ground in communities are saying ails them and what they need to be made whole. Okay, so coming back to another talking point from my definition of justice, you know, I hate the word criminal justice. My definition of justice is being made whole.
Why do you hate criminal justice?
Well, I think it triggers some associations between race and criminality, between blackness specifically and criminality, that I think we should should get rid of. I think every time we say it on some level, I think we're triggering that association, whether we know it or not. Hmm. And I think we do better. And then I think that if you have a notion of justice that leads with criminality, that begins with criminality, it ends with criminality. And it limits your ability to think about what justice actually is, right? Which for me is safety and healing and being made whole, right? So
I just kind of transitioning or pulling back a little bit to, because we've gotten a lot of questions about policing, which I know is like one part of this much bigger thing. But when you think about, this question's from online, some police departments have already implemented some reforms like implicit bias training, increasing diversity on police forces, and de-escalation training. Do you see these reforms as showing any results?
So I can't give you a data-driven answer, okay? So I won't pretend. But there's nothing implicit about a knee on the neck, nothing at all. So if you have an Asian American officer standing, looking at a camera that's filming George Floyd's murder, I'm not sure how much diversity training or how much diversifying the police department is going to correct that. I think, you know, I know, for instance, you know, and even beyond those examples, you know, people talk about outlawing chokeholds. Well, chokeholds are illegal in lots of places. I mean, making it illegal doesn't do it. Implicit bias training doesn't do it. Kind of diversifying the police department isn't going to do it. It's not. I mean, you know, there's black and there's blue. And, you know, it's sad but true that there is something about the nature of policing in this country, I think, that is toxic and dangerous. And I think that thinking that we're going to be able to reform the practice of policing by adopting, even a citizen review board. I mean, that's post hoc, and I'm not sure that they're effective. I think we need to be quite a bit more radical in the things that we think about, and we need to kind of. So anyway, so I know you have more questions. So
Well, and so some of these you've gotten to already, but when you're thinking about reimagining. This question comes from Marcelina. So then what strategies can be used towards reform with, for example, police unions that protect, quote, bad cops? Oftentimes we find officers committing crimes, have multiple complaints against them, and they're still out there with weapons.
Limiting, I would say, the role of police unions isn't a matter of reform. It should be a matter of law. And in point of fact, you know, there weren't always police unions, just like there weren't always police, right? So is eliminating police unions necessary? Yes. Is it enough? No. What do we need? So in different parts of the country, there are people who are starting to understand how to make their communities safe and whole. They're doing work, you know, so that in fact, if somebody sees someone sleeping in his car in a parking lot, that person can call a number and get some help. That's not the police, right? And nobody has to die, right? And that, you know, and that's where we are right now. We don't, you know, we don't need policing to make us safe. The policing is making us unsafe. Hmm. So, and believe me, there are people in communities that are doing this work for themselves, right? And so this idea of kind of taking some money, you know, from, you know, putting some social workers in the police department or whatever. I mean, no, it's not about that. We're past that. We really have to open our eyes and our minds and our hearts to the fact that police didn't always exist. That think about what happened when the cops went out on de Blasio in New York, right? And they, did New York fall apart? No, right? There were probably people in New York who felt safer when those cops were off the street. So we have to, and part of the problem is that people in suburban communities feel safe and they don't see the police all the time. They don't know, recognize, or understand what it's like to live in occupied territory. So the little reforms, if the person in the uniform is black or whatever color, it's still the uniform. And the mission is still policing and not healing and not taking care of us.
This time went by really fast.
Sorry.
And so I want to, you know, bring this back. We're getting a lot of questions about what people can do next. And I know you've talked about that with voting and thinking about how to locally and kind of keep that momentum going and not just kind of curl back. But I also wonder how you see that in terms of intersections with coronavirus right now and kind of these overlapping or intertwined threats and challenges.
Well, I think we need to think about that kind of devoting more resources to addressing the issues that create the disparities in prevalence in susceptibility to coronavirus, right? So we need to think about, again, you know, kind of more resources to address those underlying conditions, which include a whole range of things that cost money, yes, but actually contribute to the good, such that, you know, the communities across the country share the same relative health in terms of being able to fight the virus, right? And so finally, my last point would be that even if we have a vaccine and we quote kind of are able to survive the virus, we can't forget the lesson the virus taught us. We still have to do those things. We still have to insist on those resources, whether it's something simple like planting trees so that communities of color aren't heat zones all summer, right? They're basic things that some people are able to take for granted that people living in our cities can't. And so I think going forward, I hope that's an answer to your question.
That was David Harris, Managing Director of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard's Law School. This Q&A was jointly presented by The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the full video of this discussion on our Facebook pages at Forum HSPH and at PRI The World, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.